Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Mark Russo.
And I'm H. Bosch Jr. Today we are discussing the DSA's Mutual Aid Shovel Brigade.
Then, Brosh brings us another installation of Education, Empowerment, and Entrepreneurship, featuring Jeff Deskovic.
Afterwards, we'll hear from the youth interns.
And later on, we'll meet with labor organizer Liz Moran.
Finally, dancer Dale Caron talks about his work.
Let's start the show off with some headlines.
Capital Region colleges and universities are keeping a close eye on Washington as federal cuts to the student aid programs and rhetoric around immigration threaten to limit colleges' access, affordability, and international enrollments at the local level. The colleges are also worried that federal tax reform and a package of tax cuts approved by Congress late last year will cut private donations.
Controversy continues to surround the high number of arrests for marijuana in New York City, which overwhelmingly involve people of color. The new city council speaker dismissed the explanation by the police department that NYPD cops make the most arrests based on where they get the most complaints from neighbors. The Daily News reported that NYPD's own data showed no firm link between complaints and arrests, despite the fact the arrest number. The NYPD continues to make tens of thousands of marijuana arrests annually, despite the fact that the possession of small amounts of cannabis was decriminalized in New York years ago.
U.S. Senator Charles Schumer is proposing to fund $1 trillion in infrastructure upgrades across New York by eliminating what he says were tax breaks to the nation's wealthiest individuals and corporations. The proposal would also guarantee that broadband services are provided to all residents across the state, even in remote areas.
President Trump ordered steep tariffs on Thursday on imported steel and aluminum from every country in the world except Canada and Mexico. Trump campaigned on a protectionist platform that is sharply at odds with Republicans' free trade orthodoxy. Domestic steelworkers have applauded the president's move. Authority for the tariffs comes from a seldom-used law from the 1960s that was designed to protect domestic industries deemed vital to national defense, although military officials questioned the need for tariffs. And if you're just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM.
To learn more about the program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Snow has been piling up on neighborhood sidewalks throughout the Capital Region recently. The Troy branch of the Capital District Democratic Socialists of America has organized a mutual aid snow brigade to help shovel out. Earlier today, I met with Matthew Skellick, chair of the Troy DSA, to talk about their effort. Hello, Matthew. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Mark. Glad to be here.
So why was this shovel brigade needed?
Well, we live in the community and we noticed there's a lot of sidewalks that are slippery and dangerous to get around throughout the city, especially in neighborhoods outside of downtown. And if you're in a wheelchair or if you use a walker or have a baby in a stroller, it becomes very difficult. And even people who are able-bodied are walking in the streets and in traffic. That's, up here in Lansingburg, in North Central, cars zip by and it's very dangerous.
But doesn't the city clear the snow from curb cuts and bus stops and places like that?
No. So that's why we're doing it. Even responsible landlords and property owners tend to not clear out things like bus stops and the curb cuts. There are some public workers who you can see out downtown clearing out the curb cuts and making sure that all the water piled up drains away. But they don't have the resources to get out into the neighborhoods. We love the public workers, but we want them to have the resources they need to service the entire city.
So if the city isn't clearing the snow from in front of buildings, who is at the end responsible for clearing that snow?
Usually the responsibility falls upon the landlord. And this, in some cases, the landlord is the city, especially with some of these. There's a lot of city-owned foreclosed properties. There's a lot of parks, especially outside of downtown. They get neglected.
So even though the tenant might be the one who would fall and slip walking outside of their building if the snow isn't cleared, it is not, in fact, the tenant's responsibility, but the landowner's responsibility, barring, I would imagine, some kind of specific lease agreement?
That's right. That's right. Some people may take it upon themselves because their landlord isn't doing it, but the responsibility is usually the landlord. A lot of landlords subcontract those services out to property managers, and especially if the snow falls on a weekend, they don't deal with it. And there's potential legal liabilities for landlords. They could be potentially fined by the city. And we'd like the city to step up and enforce the law that's on the books and take on these absentee landlords. But ultimately, we'd like to see something more sustainable that either the city is finds a way to keep the city accessible and usable and just navigable for all its residents.
What other mutual aid efforts does the DSA have lined up for the next few months?
So the Troy DSA is pretty new. We had our first meeting in November, and especially in the winter, this was our first big project. Coming up, we have a meeting later in the month, and there we'll be starting to plan something that other chapters across the country have been doing, a free brake light repair clinic. This is a way, it's a sort of way to help people not get pulled over by the police. If you have a brake light out, it's something that is, it's fairly easy to do if you know how to do it, but can be a big problem if you get pulled over, especially if you're a person of color. We have a problem with policing in this city, and a tail light out can be a big problem. So we're hoping once it warms up to have a big pile of brake lights for a bunch of common makes and models of cars, and to spend a day replacing them for folks who need it.
Fantastic. A really thoughtful contribution to marginalized people in our community. So if folks are interested in joining the DSA or coming to one of your meetings, where can they find information about you?
We have Facebook, facebook.com/CapitalDistrictDSA. We're on Twitter, CapDistrictDSA. And we have an email address, albanydsa@gmail.com. Those are all good ways to reach us. We have an upcoming meeting in Troy on March 22nd at 6:30 at Oakwood Community Center. And there's a national website, dsausa.org. We are a membership organization, but you can join and pay dues. But you don't have to be a member to come to a meeting and participate in our program. So if anyone wants to help shovel, I hope people come join us in the future. Hopefully this was the last big snowstorm of the year, but who knows?
And how. Well, thanks again, Matt, for joining us.
Thanks, Mark.
That was Matthew Skellick, chair of the Troy DSA. To learn more, visit dsausa.com.
I had the opportunity to sit down with guest Jeff Deskovich. Jeff is an internationally recognized expert in wrongful convictions and founder of the Jeff Deskovich Foundation for Justice. Jeff spent 16 years in prison, wrongfully convicted of murder and rape before he was exonerated by DNA testing. H. Boss Jr. with the Triple E segment of the show, Education, Empowerment, Entrepreneurship. I'm going to dig right in. Jeff, tell us about your case. My first question is, describe how you were wrongfully convicted.
So I was arrested when I was 16. I was 17 by the time the trial rolled around. My wrongful conviction, which happened despite a pretrial negative DNA test result, was caused by a coerced false confession, prosecutorial misconduct, fraud by the medical examiner, terrible public defender. And add it all up, I was wrongfully convicted of a murder and rape, which I did not commit. And ultimately, I spent 16 years wrongfully imprisoned.
Wow.
Prior to being proven innocent through further DNA testing via the DNA data bank, which not only reaffirmed my innocence, but also identified the actual perpetrator. who was subsequently arrested and convicted. Super quickly, I along the route of doing the 16 years, I lost 7 appeals and I got turned down for parole, despite being otherwise an ideal candidate, kind of what previous interview subject Cheryl Katz-Bentman spoke about, innocent people being denied parole due to maintaining their innocence, so kind of an overlap into my story. Mm-hmm.
Talk to us about readjusting to being released into society and what challenges have you faced? I remember one particular story which was just blew my mind when you talked about you were so cautious that you were literally scared to walk across the street for jaywalking. So, you know, go ahead.
Yes.
Not to steal your thunder.
Not at all. Plenty of after effects to get into. No shortage of material. So in no particular order, the difficulty in adjusting, I mean, obviously there's going to be psychological after effects of being wrongfully in prison. So from I did a lot of work with therapists dealing with PTSD, anxiety, panic attacks, feeling of being frozen in time, like feeling like I was 17 again, which was the last year I was free. So imagine feeling 17 when you're at 32, but mm-hmm. not in some fountain of youth, wonderful type of way, but instead
it took that whole period of your life.
Yes, yeah, exactly. So from that aspect to it, then, you know, social stigma. Okay, you were in prison wrongfully, yes, but you were in prison for 16 years. So how much of that rubbed off on you? Is it safe to have you around, be alone someplace with you? That's a psychological and social. But the other aspects to that, technology was different. Like, we didn't have Bosch. We did not have the internet. There was no cell phones.
You missed that
GPS. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then I missed the natural
The
actual progression of life. I mean, I lost from 17 all the way up until 32.
Junior prom.
I didn't go. I didn't go to the prom. I didn't graduate high school. Births, deaths, weddings. Mm-hmm. Not being established in career. The culture was much different. So, between the culture and the technology, and then the physical change in neighborhoods I was familiar with, I mean, had the cumulative effect of making me feel like I was a fish out of water, that mm-hmm. I didn't quite belong here, that this wasn't my world. But yet I didn't belong in prison either because I was innocent. So, mm-hmm. you know, like
you
a man without a country, I'm caught in the middle.
Right.
Neither fish nor
damn
fowl.
If you do, damn if you don't.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
So let me ask you this then. You became an advocate upon your release. Tell us why and talk a little bit about your body of work, The Bow.
Sure. So I became an advocate because I needed to take something out of the negative experience that happened to me. I needed to make my suffering count for something. So when I was released, I gave an off-the-cuff two-and-a-half-hour presentation to the media.
That was a real off-the-cuff.
Right. But everything I ever wanted to say in 16 years and could never get anyone to hear, it all came out. And just when I thought I was finishing up, another topic came to mind. So it was at that moment I realized that I could be part of the innocence movement without necessarily being a lawyer. So I embarked on this advocacy career. So some of the highlights, I've done maybe 100 presentations across the country. I became a weekly columnist. I did that for 5 years. Mm-hmm. Teamed up with New Yorkers Against the Death Penalty. We fought off capital punishment reinstatement efforts in 2007. Mm-hmm. So they introduced me to the world of lobbying and going to legislative hearings. And I made the decision early on to trade privacy in exchange for greater awareness, hence doing an ungodly amount of interviews.
You decided that your life mission was to serve.
Yes.
And my friend, you have done a phenomenal job.
And that's how I make sense of what happened to me in a kaleidoscopic type of way. I believe I am doing the work that I'm meant to do.
Pause. Get that word, kaleidoscopic. Go right ahead. So, all right, let me ask you this then. Tell us a little bit about the Jeff Deskovich Foundation.
Okay, so I was an individual advocate for about 5 years. And then I was finally financially compensated, and I reached a crossroads. You know, do I want to just continue to be just an individual advocate, or do I really want to ramp this thing up and take it to the next level? So I decided that I wanted to go to the next level. So I committed $1.5 million from the money I received, and I started the Jeffrey Deskovich Foundation for mm-hmm. Justice, who would continue the awareness and policy work that I did as an individual advocate, but mm-hmm. more importantly, do things I could never do as an individual. So specifically, I wanted to exonerate people. So in our 5 years of existence, we exonerated two people, William Lopez, who was in for 23.5 years, William Hawley. We got another 4 people out through alternative means, because it's not always able to prove was something new.
Okay.
And we had a hand in helping to pass some laws in Albany a couple of years ago.
So that leads me into my next question and asking you about some of the foundation more notable cases.
Yeah, sure. Well, William Haughey, and I mentioned, and William Lopez. But I want to highlight some cases of other people who are currently wrongfully in prison, current mm-hmm. clients that we believe will be exonerated. Yeah, definitely. Carolyn Warmus is one case, the same medical examiner who mm-hmm. altered his testimony in my case, changed the time of death in hers. Mm-hmm. I want to highlight Andrew Krivak, who's been in for 18 years, the same polygraphist who coerced the false confession out of me, did the same thing to Andy. Imagine being wrongfully imprisoned on a case where you have a co-defendant, and your co-defendant on the same set of facts, he's out and you're still in.
Wow.
That's his – yeah, his co-defendant, mm-hmm. Anthony DiPippo, in the National Registry of Exonerations, right. And yet his co-defendant's mm-hmm. still in. So I want to highlight that case, Hector Lopez, who Scarcella, the corrupt detective from Brooklyn, right, claimed that he confessed to him, right? There's a lot of cases where Scarcella's have been overturned, but yet from a scientific point of view, in an arson case, which I know you know all about.
Oh boy, am I all too familiar with arson.
So get a load
that's a whole nother story for another time.
Right, yeah. But get a load of this, though. The arson expert says that from a scientific point of view, that the fire did not happen in the way in which Scarcella's claiming our client confessed. Yeah. So you know how that went.
Right.
So those
Let me ask you this thing real quick, because you're world renowned. Are most of your cases just centered in New York State?
The bulk of them are in New York State, but an mm-hmm. exception for that is we are able to do DNA cases nationally. That's more a situation of you can do it by remote control. It's really expensive to run an out-of-state non-DNA investigation. So mm-hmm. a future aspiration would be to, kind of like borrowing off the ACLU model, would love to have a chapter in each state and eventually in every country, because you know what? Wrongful convictions is not a U.S. problem. It's a worldwide problem. We don't hear about that in other countries. You know why? Because the errors aren't corrected over there, mm-hmm. and there's no one working to do it.
The late Dr. Martin Luther King said,
injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere.
How about that? So I want to cherry pick a little bit. So I want to tell us about going to school, college, in prison. What was that experience about?
Sure. So I was arrested when I was 16, as I shared earlier, which mm-hmm. meant I didn't graduate high school, but I did get the GED while I was in prison. I was determined to minimize the loss that I was experiencing. Mm-hmm. So I obtained an associate's degree while in prison, and I completed an additional year of schooling towards the bachelor's. You know, I saw people that from being in the regular cell blocks to being housed in the prison college block, and I saw the transformative impact that the college education had. Mm-hmm. And it made me have to do that much less work. When I eventually was exonerated,
right.
I was further along. I wasn't starting from scratch in my formal education.
So you were smart, yeah, to realize education was going to be the key to you forwarding your life and doing it in a way where you could truly make a difference. Now, after the settlement then, I just think there should be a buildup, because I am so proud of you, man. How did law school come into play? And, man, I can't say enough words about you, brother. You know, I told you, when you walk across that stage, you walk across there for me. You know you're standing on my shoulders and a whole lot of people. I might run up on the stage and just act a fool, so be prepared. But tell me about law school, all right?
Absolutely. So
phenomenal.
So when I was released, the Journal News, which is a daily newspaper in Westchester, they had as a human interest item in their story, along with my release and exoneration, that I was 10 classes short of a bachelor's degree. So Mercy College reached out to me on their own and gave me a full scholarship, so I finished the bachelor's degree in psychology. I tried to go to law school. I couldn't get in. The LSATs were really hard. Mm-hmm. And so not being able to do that, I instead decided to go to grad school, where I got a master's degree from the John Jay College of Criminal Justice with my thesis in wrongful conviction causes and reforms. And then I decided to go back again to pursue the dream. See, my dream growing up was to be a lawyer. My mother had a personal injury lawyer, and he was always well-dressed.
And
he seemed to be well-respected. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to keep pursuing that dream, but it was for a far different motivation. So I got into the Elizabeth Hobbs School of Law at Pace University, where I'm almost finished with my second year of law school out of three in pursuit of my dream of exonerating more people only as a lawyer. I want to exonerate people as a lawyer. It's not enough anymore to sit in the front row where even though I might have brought the lawyer in, the lawyer might be working for me. I might have prepped him.
Right.
But I can't sit at the desk. I can't, and I can't talk to
the
judge.
You're actually going to have an
now
effect on people's lives.
I want to be direct. So to bring in an NFL football analogy, right? The Super Bowl just ended. Mm-hmm. I'm tired of being the head coach. Okay, I want to get in the game and play quarterback. I want to play quarterback.
Well said. So
I just wanted to share, you know, that it's really important to me, and I know you know this, but just for listeners that this may be the first time ever encountering me, you know, I'm an advocate, and my motivation, my drive is what happened to me. Mm-hmm. I'm not like what happened to me. There's a huge difference, and being recognized that way really means a lot to me. And I've been able to position myself in the middle, in which I don't compromise on justice issues, but I am understood that I'm against injustice. I'm not like anti-cop, anti-prosecutor. I'm anti-corrupt cop. I'm anti-rogue prosecutor, a prosecutor that goes outside the
room. And that's the message we want to give out on the station. We're not anti-cop.
Right.
We're anti-bad cop. We got to end. We got to get you back here. But I thank you, brother, for showing up, and I appreciate you gracing us with, you know, this interview and taking time out of your very, very busy schedule. Ladies and gentlemen, Jeff Desovich, as I say, the incomparable Jeff Desovich, world-renowned speaker. Till next time, folks, it's about the triple E's: education, empowerment, entrepreneurship. And remember this, don't hear about making a difference. You need to be about making a difference. This is Inez Bosch. I always give a tribute to my mom. This is Inez Bosch's baby boy, H. Bosch Jr.
That was WOOC correspondent and host H. Bosch Jr. interviewing Jeffrey Deskovich, founder of the Jeffrey Deskovich Foundation for Justice.
For those just tuning in, I'm H. Bosch Jr.
And I'm Mark Russo. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org.
Each Thursday, we feature the voices of youth from the Capital Region. Today, we are joined by WOOC youth interns Ariana Young and Aaron Pinder. Today, they are talking about International Women's Day.
So, in 1910, the day of March 8th, it was suggested as the International Socialist Conference as a good day for an International Women's Day.
Who are some women in your life that you feel is your role model?
I will have to say my mother.
Why your mother?
For example, a time where my father got arrested, and it was just like my mother and me and my older sister. And it's like, it was only like one income coming in. So like, it was really difficult to like pay bills and stuff. And then she had like eventually like a second job to provide for the family.
Why is it important for women to be leaders in society?
I feel like it's important because we have been like dehumanized in the past and sexually assaulted and like compared to men like inferior.
Are the messages that people say about young girls in like real?
What messages specifically?
Like, how is like being a girl and a boy?
Yeah, because people might be like, oh, you're a girl, so you can't do this, and like they get like the boys like the like different kind of jobs, I guess you can say, like because they're like seen as stronger and things like that.
How do you feel about International Women's Day?
I feel like it's really good. I feel like it's really like about time that we've have like a day just for women, for everything that we have accomplished in the past and now today.
Is there anything you want to add on to that?
Maybe just like, well, yeah, what would you like to add on?
Like from my experience, I would say my mother too, because, you know, she's working two jobs, you know, and trying to like help us like stay focused in school. And I don't know how she does it sometimes, but, you know, she does it. I'm thankful for her every day, you know, just to wake up and see her every day. And, yeah.
So how do you feel about, like do you hear, like, the stereotypes about girls, and how do you feel about it being a boy?
I think for a girl, it's, like, hard because, like, certain things you can't do and certain things you can't do. for example, like, for a guy, like, say a guy is talking to multiple people, it's okay. But if a girl is talking to another person, it's called Jezebel. She's like a Jezebel. And it's, like, hard for them to, like, even be kind of doing, like, a guy thing because they'll be, like,
always seen as, like, inferior. Yes. Would you agree? Yeah.
Well, this is WOOC correspondent Megan Marone jumping in. And I've been working with the youth, and I've been really proud of the interviews that they've done. And you've interviewed several women over the past couple of months. So what do you think, each of you, Aaron Pinder and Ariana Young, what do you think should be the goals of any women's movement? Where do you think progress should be made in terms of just general human rights and gender equity? How should people be treated the same?
You want to go?
Sure. Oh, we can talk about, like, pay, you know, because, like, women isn't getting paid as much as men and things like that. And also just in, like, society, like, be able to get any job of their choice, not, like, think of it like, oh, it's like a man's job and things along those lines. What would you like to add?
I would think, like, just, like, jobs and stuff, like, they need more, we don't have to have men in everything, I would say. We need women to, like, diverse, we need more diversity in society and give, like, women a chance to, like, be them. And, like, so we already having so much stuff that there's no space for women because we segregate them into, like, this one bubble that you can't do certain things. Like, it's only a man's job. And, like, you know?
Yeah. Any other places in school where you feel like there should be more movements or progress made about how people are treated?
I feel like for, like, the whole women's day thing, like, there should be, like, clubs or, like, or in a classroom or things in general where we, like, learn about, like, women in their past. Like, it's like in the school, because, like, we don't learn about anything. Like, we don't learn about stuff like that.
Well, from what I've heard, you're in a women's empowerment club at Troy Prep. Right?
We kind of just started that up because me and a couple other students, like, went to the principal about it. You know, like, maybe we should have, like, clubs, like, more diverse stuff. And so it just kind of got started up and things like that.
So you personally petitioned the principal to get a women's empowerment club?
Yeah, me and a few other students did. With the help of Aaron, even though, like, he's a boy, like, he really believes in it because he has, like, three other sisters and stuff. So he's around a lot of women. So it was good having a boy, you know, help us with the movement.
Why did that seem necessary?
Because, like, in that school, there's a lot of, like, things about, like, sports. And, like, all the sports are, like, basketball and football. Like, you would say, like, more, like they feel like boy sports. Like girls, like, we don't got, like, things that girls can sign up for. So I just felt that it was, like, necessary for us to have things specific for us other than, like, all the things that's around sports.
Also, so last question. The year has been marked with Me Too movements and a lot of discussion about gender with actresses and a lot of famous and powerful people coming out and talking about women's issues. But then there's also discussions of how women who are in working class situations and, you know, different labor movements need to be included in the discussion of progress. So do you think that you've noticed anything distinct about this year with discussions of gender?
I think women are being more noticed in society than you, like, more than usual, because, you know, we have, like, the International Women's Day. We have, you know, we start noticing women for, like, being not just for women, but being, like, empowered, being, like, you know, all, like they're more than just, like, housewife and stuff like that. They're more just human.
Yeah, and also, like, for example, Oprah, when she was at the Golden Globes and she, you know, got that award, and she referenced, like, the civil rights and also, like, women, stuff like that. So, like, a public figure, like, speaking out on it.
Do you have any more examples?
No.
Well, we're going to continue this discussion. We normally have a youth community calendar, but we're working on that for next week because Trayvon Votrin is putting that together and has been in the middle of a move. But he's going to come back with our youth community calendar next week. And also, any other youth events coming up? There's a poetry event on every Monday at Troy Kitchen. And do you think that there are any other youth events happening that people should know about?
No, not really.
There's an Underground Railroad conference happening, which there's an overlap between history and obviously all of the women that were majorly involved in the Underground Railroad. So people can look up the information about that online. And sure. Mr. Terry is here to do a labor piece, and he can tell our wider listenership about that. But Aaron, thank you so much for being
here. You're
welcome. Ariana, thank you so much for being
here. No problem. Happy to be here.
Indeed, interns, great to have you here and on the air.
Thank you.
I know for myself, I have a deep amount of gratitude for a number of different women in my life, both ones who I'm related to, teachers, and around me, who helped shape me into the grown-up man that I am today. But now we are joined in the studio by Liz Moran, the president of the Coalition of Labor Union and Women, president of the Coalition of Labor Union Women, and a labor activist, and as well as Willie, our labor segment producer. Great to have us.
Yeah, good evening. Yeah, this is the Labor Talk, and my name is Willie Terry, and today is March the 8th, and it is known as International Women History Day. On this day, there are major celebrations throughout the world to commemorate the movements and the struggles for women's rights. In America, we recognize Women's History Day as a Women's History Month. And during the month of March, we highlight the contributions of women to the events in history and contemporary society. And today on Labor Talk, we will be talking to our guest, like they said, Liz Moran, and she's president of the Capital Region Coalition of Labor Union Women, that's better known as CLU. Good evening, Liz, and happy International Women's Day and month.
Oh, thank you. Thanks. All Thanks right. for having me, Willie. I'm happy to be here today.
Okay, Liz, let's get right into the interview.
Okay.
By telling us something about yourself or your other union titles that you hold.
Okay, so my name is Liz Moran again. I am not to be confused, by the way, with the environmental specialist and guru, Liz Moran, that is also in the Capital Region. So there is two of us in this movement of labor. Currently, I am the president of the Kate Mulaney chapter of CLU, which is, again, the Coalition of Labor Union Women. That is the Capital Region chapter. So we represent labor union women here directly in the Capital Region, as far north as Plattsburgh, we welcome people, and as far south as the Westchester area. So it's kind of widespread. I'm also recently, I've been elected as the New York State CLU president. In addition to those roles, because of those roles, I am a national executive board member of the Coalition of Labor Union Women. I kind of made it there because of my role, current role, as the president of a CSCA Local 698, which is headquartered in the New York State Dormitory Authority. I serve on the executive board of the Albany County Central Federation of Labor, and I hold a seat on the board of the Capital District Area Labor Federation. So I'm pretty active in the labor movement, or at least it feels that way. I think on a personal level, I just recently decided to go back to school to get my bachelor's degree. I'm very active in my church. Thank you, brother. And I'm a wife, and I'm a mom. So in fact, today is my anniversary. So we'll be going out to dinner after this. I would say also that when people describe me, typically the words used are tenacious, direct, and compassionate. And honestly, these are typical adjectives that are used for female union leaders.
Well, Liz, let me ask you this. Boy, that's a lot, you know. But what prompted you to get involved in the labor movement? I mean, what was that thing that got you over? So I got to get involved in the labor movement.
Anger, quite frankly, and an unwillingness to accept the failure of union representation. Mm-hmm. And it sounds pretty big for someone who is very pro-labor, but it happens. You know, we're all people. Mm-hmm. People do these types of things, get active for different reasons. And I think sometimes people go off on a different path. So I was, prior to my employment at DASNY in 2000, I had never, ever belonged to a union. So when I became the training coordinator for DASNY in 2000, I immediately became a union member, which was fine. However, I really didn't get involved until about 2008. And at that time, what I was noticing was I was aware of contract and other labor issues that were not being adequately or fairly addressed by my union representative. Mm-hmm. I began then to organize members around common issues of importance, thus coercing our union reps to really do their jobs and take action on our behalf. As a result of that, in 2009, I actually decided to run for the seat of president of that local, and I won. And so now I'm on my third term as the president of that local, and I'm super proud to be able to say that I'm the first female president of the local and the first Hispanic president.
Mm-hmm. What is DASNY? So, DASNY.
DASNY is the Dormitory Authority State of New York. So we are a state authority. Mm-hmm. We are a public benefit corporation.
Okay. And let me just get into now, you're president of the Coalition of Labor Union Women. What is that?
So the Coalition of Labor Union Women is a nonprofit, nonpartisan, which is very important, organization of trade union women that are affiliated with the AFL-CIO. We consider ourselves a bridging organization that connect the feminist movement with the labor movement. CLU is America's only national organization for women.
And when would that group start?
So for years, America witnessed and experienced the atrocities against working people. And, you know, to some extent, we're still seeing that. With the passing of the Equal Pay Act in 63 and the Civil Rights Act of 64, there was a need for women to have one voice on issues that affected them. Mm-hmm. And at that time, there were many women labor unions before CLU even got started, but they didn't support all women and discriminated against certain races. Excuse me. CLU was founded, actually, in my home city of Chicago, Illinois, in 1964 by a very diverse group of female labor leaders with the purpose of, and there was four goals, and we maintain these goals today, of increasing the number of organized women workers, implementing affirmative action, working for the passage of legislation that is favorable to working women, and for all, really, working people. And to increase women's involvement for unions.
Do y'all have any major activities or programs that y'all are working on at this point?
Well, we're constantly working on issues. Mm-hmm. So some of the programs and issues that CLU is involved on a national level mm-hmm. is, again, with the purpose to support legislation and actions that are favorable to working women. We launched an election project in 2000 that focused on having women registered to vote, as well as getting more women involved in political activities, including, which is real important because there's a resurgence of this, including running for public office. We revived this with another Get Out the Vote campaign in 2008. We also established the Contraceptive Equity Project, which notified union members and women about legal, political, and medical issues related to gaining contraceptive coverage. In addition to that, we have a Cervical Cancer Prevention Works Project, which empowers women with information on how to prevent the disease. And we're very proud to say that we were the lead organization, in passing the 2009 Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, mm-hmm. which was to restore protection against pay discrimination, which, if you might recall, had been stripped away by the Supreme Court in 2007. Locally, with the Kate Mulaney chapter, we've supported things like the New York State Paid Family Leave, which was recently came into law in 2016. We've supported the efforts for Fight for 15, Equal Pay Endeavors. Those are just to name a few.
Right. Now, who can join CLU? And then let's say, what were some of the benefits of a person being a member of CLU?
So any labor activist and member can join CLU. It's not just for working women. It is for our working men as well, and we welcome that. There are so many benefits to joining CLU. I would say as an activist, I've grown tremendously since being a part of the Coalition of Labor Union Women. I'm fighting right next to other women who have the same passion to improve working conditions for our union sisters and really all workers. CLU provides an incredible support system that encourages us to work with one another and to bridge the labor movement gaps that can exist between unions and groups. Additionally, as a labor leader, no better organization has provided development opportunities to me than CLU has. CLU provides that unique opportunity to learn more about other unions of the labor movement while pulling you up to the next step. And it's incredibly important for us. I think CLU's sisters reach back and extend a hand to pull you up the ladder. For me, if the lift has been too heavy, I know that I have other sisters who will lower their hands so that together we can elevate one another. And in the end, we can move some mountains.
But how are you structured, you know, in reference to national and local?
So we do have a national organization. As I mentioned, I'm a, mm-hmm. a member of the National Executive Board. The national organization is led by 19 National Officers Council, 19 women of the National Officers mm-hmm. Council, and our National Executive Board. The National Executive Board includes the council itself, chapter and state presidents, like my role that I perform here in New York State, union and chapter delegates. We have two paid staff members. That's it. Everything else that we do is voluntary and by the support of our sisters and brothers in labor. Nationwide, our members are from about 54 international and national unions, and we have around 40 chapters across the states. In New York State, though, we have five chapters. So in New York State, we have here locally our Kate Mullaney chapter. We have a Rochester chapter, a Western New York chapter, a New York Metro chapter, and a Long Island chapter. And each of those chapters, in any of our structure, they're all elected by the Sisters of CLU. So, for here locally, we hold meetings. We mm-hmm. hold monthly meetings. Mm-hmm. We recognize that we need to be able to practice what we preach. And part of what we preach is that we're accommodating women everywhere and supporting their roles, not just as mothers and breadwinners, but also as activists. And so our meetings, while they are held monthly, the first Monday of every month, they're also held virtually. So anybody can connect via the web or just by telephone if for some reason they can't make the meeting itself. So we're pretty proud of that.
Mm-hmm. So is there a fee of joining to join?
There is a fee. To become a national, you have to be a national member in order to be a chapter member. A national, for a new membership, it's simply $45. Mm-hmm. And then the chapter fee ranges for New York State CLU chapters anywhere between $10 and $25. So it's fairly economical, and it is an annual fee.
And when do y'all meet again, you said?
So the Kate Mullaney chapter meets the first Monday of every month.
Is there anything else? I mean, you told us a lot, and I'm sure you got a lot more to say. But is there anything else you would like to say, you know, to our radio audience about CLU?
There is, actually. So being that it's Women's History Month, I do want to say I want to leave your audience with a bit of history. And this will dovetail on some of the other segments that you've had. In 1848, Elizabeth Cady Stanton held the very first Women Rights Convention here in Seneca Falls, New York. Mm-hmm. She created a declaration of sentiments based on the Declaration of Independence, and it read, "The history of mankind is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations on the part of man toward woman, having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over her. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. Married women were legally dead in the eyes of the law. Women were not allowed to vote. Women had to submit to laws when they had no voice in their formation. Married women had no property rights. Husbands had legal power and responsibility for their wives to the extent that they could imprison or beat them with impunity. Divorce and child custody laws favored men, giving no rights to women. Women had to pay property taxes, although they had no representation in the levying of those taxes. Most occupations were closed to women, and when women did work, they were paid only a fraction of what men earned. Women were not allowed to enter professions such as medicine or law. Women had no means to gain an education. With only a few exceptions, women were not allowed to participate in the affairs of the church, and women were robbed of their self-confidence. We have come a long way since 1848, but clearly you can see that there's some issues that we're still struggling with. There has never been a time where passivity builds a workforce, nor has there ever been a time where inaction gets the job done, Willie. Every day is a here and now, and every day you have an opportunity to do more for yourself and others. Clue is your here and now. It's time to get a clue.
Right.
And that's what I leave you with.
Right. Thank you, Liz, for informing our radio audience about the Coalition of Labor Union Women. And I know there's much, much more about Clue that you can talk about. And I hope you will come back again so we can learn more about what Clue is doing. And if there are any women or men in union listening, please talk to your unions about joining Clue. Thank you for listening. Until next time, this is Willie Terry, and I'm your host for Labor Talk.
Thank you both for joining us. Again on Thursday, we've been featuring the voices of not only youth, but also local artists and poets. Today, we venture into the world of dance. For over 20 years, Dole Caron has been a registered nurse, Dale Caron has been a registered nurse, yoga practitioner, and an explorer of many spiritual paths. He lived for a season in 1996 at Kripalu Yoga Center in Lenox, Massachusetts. Several years later, he was certified at Kripalu to teach a form of conscious dance called Dance Kinetics. In 2016, he discovered the ecstatic dance evolution and was profoundly inspired by its simplicity, healing power, and community-building potential, and so became a facilitator. Since the summer of 2016, he has been facilitating at Ecstatic Dance in Albany and has facilitated several weekend special events in Albany, Troy, and Saratoga, and at Stablegate Farm in Castleton, New York. For Dale, dance is not just a form of exercise. It is bodily expression meant to connect us to higher spiritual thoughts, feelings, and ontological unfoldings, and as a way for us to release and process what is stored in our minds, hearts, and bodies. He is here to discuss local dance events that are available to you. Welcome to the studio, Dale.
Thank you for having me.
That's quite an introduction. How and why did you first begin to dance?
Well, this form of dance, I began in 2016 after being introduced to a church I go to in Unity in Albany. And it so deeply inspired me because ecstatic dance integrates a lot of different forms of spirituality in it, within it, and it's a great community-building tool. Also, it's helped me to open up creatively, express myself more in new ways, and make amazing friends that are like-minded in the spiritual and dance world.
So how did you come to understand that or believe that dance is an important connection with divine?
Had some profound experiences in our dances where this type of synergy happens. It's a freestyle type of dance that starts with an opening circle. So we try to create a space where people feel safe to express themselves any way they want. And it's a sacred space that's created. So a lot of times mystical and playful things happen, and it's always like a co-creation. And so for me, that's very spiritual, and that's ecstasy.
Hey, Dale, this is H. Bosch Jr. I have a couple of questions also. Okay. What makes dance ecstatic?
Well, I feel that ecstasy means like overwhelming sense of joy. And in these dances, a format is created that allows for that and allows a lot of room for creative expression. And so the joy is the ecstasy.
Okay, wow, that sounds pretty intense.
We have a blast every Thursday.
It sounds like it. I might have to come to the next shindig.
Okay.
How do you see dance as a way of healing and processing emotional wounds and joys?
Well, I've experienced many profound moments of feeling connected with like-minded people and sharing. And the sharing circles we have at the end of the dances are powerful because it allows people to share what just happened in that dance experience, which is often profound. And sometimes even children have piped in and said it was transformative for them.
Okay, well, dance as a way to process joy. What's going on when people feel ecstatic joy when they dance? What are your favorite examples of dances from all over the world?
You're in a state of ecstasy, I feel your immune system is uplifted, empowered, and there's a sense of healing that takes place and invigoration. I always feel, and most of us feel, regenerated and rejuvenated by these co-creative dance experiences we have.
And so the other side of the joy coin is grief. And it seems that dance may also be an effective way to process grief, wailing, singing, processing all kinds of intense emotions. What has been your experience with that?
Yeah, for me, in the last couple of years since I started this, I was going through a process of dealing with depression and several losses, and it helped me to connect in with like-minded people that and feel totally safe in sharing whatever emotions come up during the dance. And sometimes, you know, tears come spontaneously or shouts. On both sides, joyful and painful, and of other people in the share back at the end of the dance have shared that having that space was healing for them and their losses.
So among many kinds of trauma, we can have the emotional trauma people experience as well as physical trauma. Is dance an effective way for dealing with physical trauma as well?
Yeah, well, there have been people in wheelchairs that came and were able to express themselves without necessarily, you know, being able to dance, just using arm movements and letting the music move them. And sometimes people don't dance. They'll just sway or, you know, honor their own limitations, but yet feel connected. I think that's the power of it.
Well, what would you give advice to somebody who may have some vulnerability with their body in terms of approaching, who wants to try dance? You know, what advice could you give them in terms of getting things done?
Well, when the opening circle, we always create a space where we encourage people to let the music move you, honor your own limitations, and emphasize that it's a judgment-free zone where, you know, you're free to move in whatever way that you need to move and interact or not interact. You know, sometimes people are shy and they'll just dance alone in the corner. And I also bring in shakers and drums and things so people can interact in that way if they don't feel like freestyle dancing.
Okay, Dale. Well, who's welcome at your dance events and where are they? And do you guys throw in any of the electric slide?
Oh, yeah, sometimes spontaneous things happen. We'll circle will form and we'll get crazy and wild. I always wear a wig when I facilitate and kind of remind people it's okay to be crazy. Some people bring in scarves and things and props. The dances are every Thursday night. Move Fitness by Lenny on the corner of Colvin and Lincoln Avenue in Albany. 24 Lincoln Avenue? Colvin. Okay. 24 Colvin Avenue. 7:45 tonight, okay. There's a dance.
Great. Well, how can people get more information about your dance class and the upcoming Soul Train line?
The Albany Facebook page, Albany Ecstatic Dance Evolution, and we have a page on Meetup also.
Groovy. Now, so beyond ecstatic dance, do you have any experience with more formal dance types, like modern or jazz?
Not modern or jazz. More these fusion type of dances, like well, there's the thing, Nia dance is a conscious form of dance, integrates martial arts, and there's the thing, well, Zumba, a little bit of experience with Zumba, and things like that, but freestyle dances.
Groovy. And we have a name that showed up for us when we were talking about you, Leslie Thornton.
This started with out in Houston, Texas, this form of ecstatic dance. And this is kind of like a franchise from Houston. There's where the main site where the DJs that form these playlists are mainly in the Houston area where it began. And Leslie owns the franchise in this Albany Ecstatic Dance Evolution, but it's based in Houston. That's where we get the playlists and the opening, you know, suggestions for opening circle.
Groovy. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Dale.
Thank you so much for having me. And, there's another dance Saturday night at Unity Church in Albany, 7 p.m. So
be there or be square.
Soul Train.
Hey, that was Dale Carone speaking with us about the poetry of dance. Stay tuned to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine for more information about local dance, poetry, and music events. With that, we conclude our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Mark Russo.
And I'm H. Bosch Jr. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page.
As a friendly reminder, WOOC 105.3 is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday night at 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.